Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and it's Tech Expert Day, talking about cooling down your computer and your cell phones. How we're going to start the show with our guest, Jesse LeGru. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. And Jesse will cover how to ensure your text messages and emails are secure. So I hope you'll join in. When's your phone getting hot? Or maybe you can share your secrets to keep your emails secure. We'll take your general tech questions as well, and you can join us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGru, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
You know, I think there are probably several reasons why your phone or your computer can feel hot to the touch, but what causes our devices to heat up?
Most of the time, outside of just, you know, being in the sun or being in an area that's already warm or hot, it's doing work. So the more work your device does, generally, the hotter it's going to get and the need it's going to have for more cooling, whether it's by fans or what they call passive cooling or heat sinks, things that get really hot but try to dissipate that heat out into the rest of the air. But usually things are just getting hot because they're doing work. And so the more work, the hotter they get.
Yeah. How concerned should you be if your devices are hot to the touch?
You know, there are a couple of concerns. Most, at least for a lot of electronics that we receive these days, there's a lot of safety mechanisms. So if they get too hot, they might shut down. They might find ways to cool themselves off. You know, a long time ago, that may not be the case. And we might still run into it today. You know, my primary concern outside of just not being able to use the device is that the device would crash or the device would get damaged. The hotter it gets, if it's beyond those kind of safety ranges, I mean, things can get hot enough where it's hot to the touch. In some cases, maybe you could burn yourself, or if you have sensitive skin, you know, that's always a concern as well. So, you know, there are some safety concerns. There's also some concerns for the device and if it breaks or, you know, you're not able to use it again. It's a little bit different from if people have seen, you know, videos of, you know, devices exploding. You know, sometimes, you know, a lot of those were, you know, based on battery defects. But depending on the device, you know, they're meant to shut down if they you know, get too hot. So that way you're not going to be exposed to something else that might be more dangerous. So keeping your device cool and, you know, maybe giving it a little bit of a break and having it doing a little bit less work can be good.
Yeah. What about putting it in the fridge to cool it down?
Yeah, that can be, there's probably a couple, you know, it's actually kind of a natural thing of like, I'd like to keep it cool. You know, I remember days where I was actually a cook and you'd be in front of a grill and it'd be 110 and stepping in front of a, you know, a lock-in or a walk-in freezer or cooler was actually really, really nice. Not so great for electronics. There's a couple of reasons. One, that dramatic temperature change can cause strain on the components of the device. But also a refrigerator or a freezer, they actually might have a little bit more moisture than the rest of the air. So you don't want to have electronics generally in a moist area. Also too dry, you might have static. You know, that's a different risk. But that dramatic temperature change can be a little bit more of an issue. So I wouldn't recommend taking a really hot device and throwing it into a fridge or a freezer. And if you've ever, you know, kind of curious of what could happen, if you don't have cookware that might be designed for temperature extremes, in some cases you might heat something up and then you might want it dramatically cold. If you don't have the right kind of vessel to do that, it can shatter. Yeah. And so, you know, think about that, you know, an electronic device is a little bit different. But I think that's kind of an example that, you know, many of us can kind of go to of where that temperature change can actually, you know, cause some damage.
So think about desktop computers for just a second. When they overheat, sometimes will overheat, is this just the amount of work, or could there be other reasons?
Yeah, it can. Generally, it's going to warm up just because of the amount of work that the device has to do. It could be, usually it's going to be a video card, or it's going to be the main processor that's doing a lot of work and generating a lot of heat. Memory might also be a cause these days, just with high performance computers, outside of just, you know, the room that they're in. So if the room's relatively cool, that device might heat up just because it's really doing work. If it's doesn't have a lot to do, it's not really going to be heating up unless it's doing any real work. And you might notice you're using a device, all of a sudden it sounds really noisy because the fans kick up. And what it's trying to do is it's trying to, get rid of a lot of heat. That could actually be an indicator, well, my computer's working really hard. Did I actually do anything that caused it to do that? One of the things people look at too for malware or something, you know, some software not running on their device they don't want, it could be running with more power than you would otherwise want. That can actually be an indicator. Like, I'm not using it, but the fans are kicking up and the computer's obviously doing more work. Why is that? So it's an item I'd keep an eye on, because it can be a good indicator if something's a little bit happening that's a little bit more unusual, or it might just be doing updates. But I always like to keep aware of that.
Anne in Eau Claire emailed us, her device sometimes gets hot to the touch while she's charging it, and wonders, is this a problem with the charging cord they're using? Is indoors, climate-controlled area? Can a device overheat be due to a cover, perhaps?
Yeah, it can happen. So on the charger first, one of the items that others have noted, if you're using a different charger than what came with your device, it could cause issues or cause additional heat. Outside of that, more heat can be generated. Otherwise, if it's, you know, doing a little bit more work, or, you know, it is causing a little bit more strain. But yeah, the charger is one thing I'd keep an eye on, and make sure you use a charger that came with your device. Yeah. And the cable, not just the charger, because sometimes you'll get the charger and a cable separately, and you can kind of interchange those. If you do notice it's becoming a little bit more warm, I would recommend just making sure you have the charger that came with the phone. As far as the case can actually block heat exchange from the device trying to get rid of heat. So it's possible the case is actually not allowing the phone or the other a different device to kind of wick away that heat in the way that it otherwise would. So sometimes your case can actually keep that heat in. So if you do notice it's getting a little bit warm, take it out of the case. You might find that helps to make sure that the device can get rid of that heat. You could also potentially get a different case, but sometimes that can happen with different cases you get.
And just one other one, things can get dusty. Dust buildup, it's a common reason why desktop computers overheat, I understand. And I can understand it, because I'm not out there dusting my computer very often, to be perfectly honest. Is there a way to clean those vents?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to do it. One thing I might even recommend, if you do have a local repair area, they might be willing to kind of blow it out for free, you know, without charge. Some might charge. I do remember, you know, opening a case. Depending on your house, you might have a variety of dust. If, you know, there are smokers, you might have a lot of things kind of collecting in those devices, especially, you know, clogging up the fan. I do recommend, if you're able, take it outside, open the case. Some people will use an air compressor. It can be a lot of air. You can get the cans of air that you otherwise kind of get in the store, and then make sure to use the instructions on exactly where to place it. You don't want it at the wrong angle, because it'll spray liquid instead of the air you're looking for. But you can blow out all the dust and make sure that it's free of a lot of that. And even when you have it open, you can also consider upgrading fans, because sometimes the fans you get with your desktop computer, you can easily upgrade those or add additional ones just to make sure it's able to get rid of that heat. Another thing to note too, if people have built their own computers, if you do notice it's overheating, you know, you have blown it out, it does look like a lot of dust is collecting, make sure your fan is actually pointed the correct way. Huh? It's really easy to actually install a fan backwards and find out that instead of blowing air out, which is what it should do, so taking all that hot air and blowing it out, it's actually blowing air in, which means it's actually starting to collect dust and not get rid of the heat. So I always keep an eye on that. If you notice it, you know, turn on the device. You can put your hand in the back of the computer. You can kind of feel whether that air is coming out. I've done that before where I've installed a fan backwards and I find out, oh yeah, that's, you know, it's not going to help at all. If anything, it's going to make the dust and heat worse.
Let's turn to email a bit and talk a bit about email privacy, of kind of a broad topic. What are the tech experts mean when they talk about email privacy?
Yeah, there are a couple of items. One, I think, is, you know, trying to keep the information for your email really only for your eyes and the people that you're corresponding with. So, and this kind of comes down to the privacy and in terms of service use for whatever email provider you have. Are they reading your email to deliver ads or other content or for any other reason? So, you know, one I always recommend when you look at your email provider, make sure you know what they're doing with your data. And that could also change. So today they may not be using it for anything. Tomorrow they might be. And that does change, unfortunately, on a day-to-day basis, depending on your provider. Email encryption can be really, really useful. One, to safeguard that data from anyone, including potentially your vendor. Email is generally pretty insecure, kind of like our telephone system, I'd say our telephone's probably worse. So using email encryption, knowing, using a provider that you do trust and that has a well-stated privacy policy or terms of service in terms of what they're going to do with your data is really important. Just because, you know, you never know whether they might share that data with any outside party or whether they may use that data internally for other purposes. So I do recommend kind of keeping an eye on that. But if you can encrypt all of your email, no one can read it anyway. So that's even better. So if you do have that capability to encrypt your email, which is built into some services, or you can add it on yourself, it can be, you know, a big boost to your privacy. Some of them do require a little bit more technical knowledge, some don't. That's you know, another item to consider when whatever you're using your email for and how sensitive that data is.
Yeah. So the service itself would provide that.
The service can provide it. Yeah. And a lot of them, a lot of the services will provide that email encryption free of charge. Some might come at a cost. Others, you might have to add it on yourself. Adding it on yourself is generally a little bit cumbersome. Most day-to-day end users are not going to want to go through all of that work to use different technologies like Pretty Good Privacy or PGP. It's just a little bit more beyond what most people are willing to do. You know, Outlook and a variety of other tools out there currently do have kind of turn on encryption here. The experience for the person receiving your email might be a little bit different. They might have to click on a special link or type in a code to enter to actually view the email, but it can help to make sure that no one else is able to see it. And there's a kind of a big asterisk there where some data may be encrypted, some may not, which makes it even more tricky. So I'd say, you know, when thinking about email security, think about the data that you're receiving or sending with that email account. If most of your emails are not that sensitive, you might actually want to use a separate account, one for, you know, general non-secure relatively benign communications. But those that are a little bit more sensitive and ones you want to protect, use a different email account. Which, you know, it's hard enough to have just one account and manage it. Having multiple can be really, really challenging, but it can help you kind of secure those items that are needed. But it can actually help a lot with spam and phishing too. If you have a really a more secure private email account that you use for sensitive data, and don't give that out otherwise, you're not going to see spam. You're not going to get a lot of the other things that you'd otherwise see. At least you're going to see less of it, most likely. So that can be really handy.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. If you have a question, maybe about what we've been talking about, or maybe you've got another IT question that you want to pose to Jesse, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa is our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computers today with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. Do you have a problem or a question about technology? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. You know, emails aren't the only way people communicate online, of course. There are messaging apps like Facebook, Messenger. How private are those instant messenger apps?
Yeah, it's another good question, and it comes down to very similar thoughts regarding email. So what are the providers going to be doing with your content? How might they be reusing it for their own purposes, or even either sharing or selling it with outside parties? So while no one loves to read the terms of service, I always recommend taking a peek, especially when they change it, because sometimes those changes give you an indicator of, you know, what are they going to do with that information? You know, for most sensitive, really, really sensitive information, I generally don't like using social media channels, just for a variety of reasons. One, you know, they can be pretty frequently attacked. Data can be exposed by you or the other party being compromised. And there's a variety of ways to do that. If there is really sensitive information, there are other communication tools that are, you know, more dedicated for that. Obviously, you know, face-to-face communication is one of the most secure, as long as you're not in a crowded room with a lot of people listening. So, you know, that can always be really good. You know who the person is, you can see them, you can talk to them. But there are some other tools. You know, Signal is an application you can use for encrypted point-to-point communications with somebody else. In the past, other people have noted, you know, WhatsApp as an option as well. One thing I do kind of like to keep in mind with a lot of the apps as well is how are, like, the ownership or organizations changing, and who owns it. So, you know, for example, a lot of people may use WhatsApp, but right now that's also owned by Meta, which is, you know, the owner of Facebook. If you have an issue with Facebook, you may want to be think about, you know, what your risk is with WhatsApp, just because, you know, as people take over organizations, the way those tools might be used and the data that's collected and how it's shared can also change. So as odd as it is, it always comes down to that terms of service and what those third parties are doing. But a lot of those can be more secure than SMS messaging. Texting can be a little bit more dangerous, you know, for people that use multi-factor authentication, which I recommend for everyone. It's a great protection for your accounts. One of the options that is generally available is SMS or text messaging, so you can get a code to your device. One reason we recommend not using text messaging is because text messaging is relatively insecure. And what a lot of people do to try to get around it is something called SIM swapping. Basically, they try to change the phone for your phone number, so they receive your text messages rather than you, which means they might be able to receive your text messages for multi-factor authentication, your other text messages. And a lot of that is really held by your phone provider. And so if somebody is able to take advantage of your phone provider and say, hey, I got a new phone, I want to activate it. Can you help me go through the process of, activating this new SIM card with my new device so that I can use my phone and texting. With a very small amount of information that might be pretty inexpensive to get, somebody might actually be able to socially engineer your phone provider, get control of your phone number, and then start receiving all of those challenge responses for multi-factor authentication. So if you're ever using your phone and all of a sudden you notice just out of nowhere, all of a sudden you don't have signal, which you had a completely strong signal before, it could be an indicator that your phone doesn't have service because it was just moved to a different device. And phone providers have been trying to get better about how they identify people, but it's still a risk. Everyone's kind of being attacked all at the same time. So it's at least one item to keep in mind for text messaging. You have a little bit more control using a third-party messenger, especially if you do, set your own strong password. You have multi-factor authentication, and you do know that it's encrypted end-to-end, and even the provider doesn't have the capability to read those messages. So I think those are really good things to think about, when at least transmitting data from point A to point B, whether it's a person or, even a company.
The other day, I got on Facebook an invitation to friend someone, and I thought to myself, "Well, I think I've already friended that person." And I went to look on my friends list because I hadn't heard from that person for a long time, and indeed, I had already friended that person.
Yeah, that's. That's pretty common. So, and I've had it happen many, many times where I've received a friend request from somebody that, I'm pretty sure I'm already friends with them. But the picture looks the same. The information looks legitimate. And when you compare, your actual friend on whatever social media platform and you compare it with the request, a lot of the information may look the same. You might also find that some of the friends you already have in common, meaning that usually this new fake account is trying to gather up the same friends that the legitimate account has so they can use it to potentially send malware, send links to compromise data or do other bad things. But that's common for a lot of social media platforms, and I've seen it quite a bit on Facebook. So if anyone does receive a friend request from somebody who, maybe you don't know or just aren't sure about, but you're pretty sure you already have as a friend, double check the information with the existing account. I also recommend if you have a friend and they contact you to do a friend request and you're pretty sure it's probably not them, contact them in a completely different way to let them know. So, whether it's by phone, maybe a different social media app, by email, but use something else outside of Facebook, for example, if that's what they're trying to friend request you on, just so you can verify, yes, this is me or no, it's not. But you may want to notify the other friends who might've friended this new fake account. But then you can go ahead and actually report it to, Facebook. Instagram is another common one. Some of those applications actually want to tell you, they'll have, I'm reporting the account because they're impersonating another user. Sometimes they actually make you type in who that other user is. And if you don't have a relationship, it kind of puts you in a weird situation where you want to report it, but they won't allow you to. And so I'll, do whatever you can to try to report it. You can also have the original person try to report it as well. But hopefully they'll deactivate those accounts pretty quick. But I like to make sure that I block those requests. I report them to Facebook or whatever provider. And if I do know a couple of friends that may have friended them without knowing, letting them know and then making sure the primary owner is also aware, because we do see it, you know, quite a bit every day. And you might see it even from a friend, hey, you know, my account got hacked, or you're getting friend requests, please ignore them. They're not real. But yeah, it happens every day, all day.
Jesse LeGru, our guest today. If you have a tech question for him or a comment, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Chris in Appleton. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Calling because of the phishing or the spam phone calls or whatever you call them. We all get them. My mom gets like two or three an hour at the least. It's really annoying. What should I do for her? I'm going to see her tomorrow. She's a Samsung phone. I don't know who her carrier is.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, they have been pretty persistent. One, you know, if her phone number is not already on the National Do Not Call Registry, I do recommend putting it on there. Even with that, you might still receive phone calls that are spam. Another recommendation is also to sign up for services with your provider. A lot of providers do have built-in services to either completely block those calls from coming in, or at least to notify you, hey, you're receiving this call, but it may be spam. And so, you know, you can at least have the choice of not answering it. And I know for my own provider, I have that option of turning that feature on and off, and it's actually handled by the provider itself. So I do recommend contacting the provider and seeing if you could take advantage of any additional services that they provide. Let's say Do Not Call, you know, you've done, you sign up for those services from your provider, and it's still really, really persistent and it's hard to get around. Another recommendation, which is a little bit more challenging, is considering getting a different phone number. The downside of that is, one, you have to update everyone what the new phone number is. So that's challenging.
Yeah.
The other challenge about it is you don't know if you're actually getting a phone number that was already in use by somebody else and what they were getting. So changing phone numbers may not actually help either. So the biggest thing I can recommend is two of those things. I have had Samsung devices as well. Some of those have their own built-in software to help identify spam calls. So at the very least, you can see it and you don't have to answer it. When my phone does alert me that this is likely spam or it is probably not legitimate, I just ignore it. I decline the call. I don't even answer. Most of the time, I don't even get voicemail, so I don't have to worry about it. And if I do get a real call, it seems pretty accurate in terms of whether it's legitimate or not. So highly recommend Do Not Call list. Check with your provider to turn on any features they have. And then the phone might actually have features that you can turn on as well, at least to identify it, if not just block it completely.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Bruce in Partyville. Hi, Bruce.
Hello there. I just want to follow up a comment. You mentioned multiple emails for doing different things, one for everyday, one for important. I'm a big believer that you should make sure you use the right tool for the right purpose. So if you're sending tax documents, go to your tax preparer and make sure they have a secure channel to upload them, etc. More importantly, I believe in the philosophy of a very, very old book called The Medium is the Message. And what it stands for is that the level of importance the recipient puts to your message does in part come from how you send it. So a text, a WhatsApp, Instagram is not going to be viewed the same as an overnight letter. That's my comment. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Comment on that, Jesse?
Yeah. And that's a really good point. I mean, generally email is not, it was not really designed. Well, one, I would argue it was not really designed, whether it was designed or not, to transmit data. You know, it's really not to send sensitive information. People have added on pieces of technology to make people do different things with email. But, you know, sending sensitive information to third parties, most third parties will have some kind of file sharing service or a method to get information from A to B. Sometimes that sensitive information may come through the mail or courier that requires signature, so the information can be more controlled. And so that is something really to keep in mind. Email's not designed to be what you're using for sensitive information. There's usually going to be a third party, and they're going to have a service that they control or subcontract to. And in addition, completely agree too with kind of urgency and when using different communications. If I really want to get a hold of somebody in a timely fashion, I'm going to call them. Maybe text messaging, you know, knowing the person's always good, but email, you know, it might be days, might be weeks, who knows? Maybe they'll never see it. They get caught off by spam. And I think that sensitivity also comes into play. If it's really sensitive, it may need to be a face-to-face communication. But yeah, definitely pick the right channel for the right person and the right content, because email generally is going to be slower. It's going to be less secure, and you know, you're going to run into other issues. So great pointers to keep in mind.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it. Let's go to John in Mason. John, hello.
Hi. I have some comments on some apps and a question.
Sure.
I have on my phone, I have a TunnelBear VPN, but I don't have Wi-Fi at home. I only use my phone through the cell tower, and VPN doesn't work that way. It only works on Wi-Fi. So, and then I also have CC Cleaner and Malwarebytes, and I pay for the premium on those. And then I use Call App, and there's a free service for Call App, and then there's a premium that you only have to pay for once. And I signed up for the premium, and it allows you to block spam and label things, and it's just a really cool app. And then the question I had was, what do you think about PeerGuardian? It's a free service. I don't know. I haven't used it since I don't use my laptop at home, but I was just wondering what you thought about PeerGuardian for a product.
Okay. Lots of things there, and I didn't get them all written down. comments, Jesse?
Yeah, I haven't used PeerGuardian myself too much.
What is it?
It's really designed to kind of block communications from to and from IP addresses or kind of network addresses on the internet, trying to block aspects of the internet from leaving or entering your network based on a list. So a lot of organizations out there will create lists of, you know, these locations are bad because we've seen malware or attacks coming from the world. And so your network basically says, I'm just not going to allow you to talk to those. And that way, if there is anything bad, even if it's attempted, it won't allow that to go through. I haven't used PeerGuardian myself or a variety of the lists that they provide, but I think using those kinds of technologies can be really helpful, especially if you know you have pretty good assurance about how those lists are being generated. One of the things we always think about is it's always good to have protections in place to block locations we might think are dangerous. When those lists are generated automatically, we're all waiting for the bad day when Google.com is blocked because, you know, some weird bad thing was seen and all of a sudden everything goes down that's Google related, which, you know, I think probably resonates with quite a few people. That being said, it's not, you know, a good or bad tool. It's just I like to be aware of the content people, other people are generating and how it impacts my own network. So if something weird happens where something's being blocked that actually causes kind of a denial of service, have a method to turn it off just to restore your internet connectivity. But I think this is one of many different options to try and limit those communications, especially if you're pretty certain that, you know, it's bad traffic. You don't want to be talking to it. And there's a lot of other services out there you can get for consumer routers for your entire internet that will help to do the same thing, either with third parties or maybe even services that they curate themselves. So I think it's definitely a good technology to consider, really for a home or a corporate network, to try to limit communication with bad things.
Yeah. John, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Bill in Racine, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Hey, my question is about Java. I stopped updating it because it just seemed as if it was so hard to update and then ask questions I couldn't answer. So I just stopped doing it. So is that, what does Java really do? I'm not into gaming or any of that. If I can get to my mail and maybe do a little shopping, that's about it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question. So, and a lot of third-party websites have really utilized Java for a variety of things. Could be games, could actually be just standard connectivity. There could be local programs you have on your computer that actually use Java. If you actually don't know of whether any programs are using it, if you're just using a standard web browser and doing most general navigation, one thing I might recommend, you know, write down the version of Java you have on your computer, just so you know if you ever had to reinstall it, and remove it. If you remove it and it doesn't change the impact of your computer and what you do on a day-to-day basis, great. One thing I always recommend for everyone is take a look at the programs you have installed. If it says they haven't been used recently, Windows will normally tell you if it has been. Remove it. The less things you have on your computer, the less things there are to update, but also the less software someone could take advantage of if you did click on you know, a phishing link or something else dangerous. So it will help with kind of other computer dangers. So I'd say remove it. If you don't notice any problem, it might have been there for something you used quite a long time ago and just don't need anymore.
Yeah, there you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. You can join in with your questions. Number to call, we'll get you on pretty quickly. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at IT issues today on the show with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Great to have him back. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Jason, who's, well, he's on I-94 in the middle of Wisconsin. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I recently moved back to the U.S. after several years in Europe, and you know, people's concern about privacy over there, I often would see on people's email footers, you know, that this information is solely for the use of the recipient to try to discourage others from forwarding it and you know, things like that. I don't understand American law on this question. Is it worthwhile to put something like that in your footer and regarding privacy? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a good question. So first, I'll preface with I'm not a lawyer, so legal advice is always best given by the professionals. That being said, there are a variety of reasons to actually give prompts for individuals regarding access to systems or access to data. A lot of things we'll commonly see, for example, on a, you know, standard device, once you log in, sometimes you'll notice you get a prompt, you know, by signing in, you agree to this, this, and this, which is usually kind of a terms of service, you know, how your use may be monitored or not. And this actually kind of goes back to a little bit of history where a lot of that was required to actually prosecute individuals should anything have been done that was not legal. So giving that preface ahead of time of how people are using a system or accessing data can be useful from kind of the litigation standpoint of whether you're able to take action should anything have happened from data access or system access and use. So, you know, there is that kind of aspect for that. I'd say it's likely the same thing for email as well. One area where I primarily see it, at least in the States, is specifically with organizations that do deal with federally or locally regulated data. And the first thing I think of is, you know, PHI, which is general health information. So if you do have a medical provider, a lot of times, pretty much every email I send out will have very similar boilerplate language on the bottom of the email is, you know, this is only intended for specific recipient. And if this is not yours, please go ahead and delete it. So it kind of puts a little bit of the onus on the user receiving the email to actually delete it. So it can be useful, you know, at least from kind of that notification standpoint, and give some other options, at least when, you know, pursuing other kind of legal investigations, at least from my novice perspective.
Mac from the Morning Show emailed with a question. Is it true that off-brand headphones and chargers can ruin your device slowly over time?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I guess it's always possible depending on the device that you get. Any device that you're using to connect to your computer, whether it's physically via Bluetooth or anything else, there's always a risk. You know, how much do you trust that device? How is it really communicating to your computer and what is it doing? You know, for example, could headphones be used to install malware on your device? It's possible. It feels a bit more challenging to do, you know, but it's a possibility. I, in terms of, you know, devices, I normally am more concerned with kind of eroding the usefulness of my device or my computer. It's usually not something that I've had too much of a concern about, but I think it is something to think about when purchasing hardware or software. Sometimes free or inexpensive can mean a trade-off with security or availability of your device. So, you know, maybe it breaks more often. Maybe it does put your device at risk. Generally paying a little bit more, hopefully, not always, but hopefully, is going to give you, you know, a better service, a better experience, and limit the risk to your own devices.
Jim in Viroqua has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi, Larry. I just wanted to make a comment or tell a little story about what happened to me and to see if your guest heard similar accounts. On July 1st, I tried to open my Coinbase account just to check my balances, and I got a notice that the account was deactivated, and they provided a number to call. And I called that number and was told that I would need to go through a three-step process, which included opening Ultra Viewer. And that gave them control of my computer. And I thought, well, that's okay, I guess. And then all of a sudden, as part of this legitimate reactivation process, he purchased $5,000 worth of Bitcoin, which was going to come out of my linked bank account. And I questioned why he had to do so much. And he said, it's just a normal process, part of the process. And he said, not to worry, the money would be going back into my account on July 12th. So I started questioning all this, and he said, don't worry and don't call your bank. So I immediately hung up, turned off my computer, and called my bank. And they said, mine, this has all the red flags. They froze my account. I had to open a new account a few days later, but my bank would not allow me to. They froze me out of being able to do any online banking until I got my computer cleaned, which I did with the Geek Squad. And it's just been a real mess. And during this, for about a week, I couldn't get a hold of anybody at Coinbase, and I couldn't even get a phone number. I have eventually talked to Coinbase and gotten that part of the deal straightened out. But I thought this was a situation where the Coinbase website appeared to have been hacked by these guys. And it just chilled me to the bone.
Yeah. Well, I would be chilling. Jesse, a comment?
Yeah, I'm sorry I had to go through that. Having that situation is never something I'd want anyone to go through, but unfortunately it's so common, it's so easy for it to happen, both with Coinbase and with other services. And the Coinbase issue has been, you know, something a lot of people have noted on, and I think there were some FBI warnings about it approximately a year ago. And, you know, a lot of it, you know, sometimes the, you know, vendors may get compromised. I don't know if that was the case for this, or maybe it was, what's it called, typo squatting. So in Coinbase.com, you type it in, you get the Coinbase website. A lot of people register domains that are close. So if you accidentally mistype something, it goes actually to something that might look like Coinbase, but may give you additional information, or they'll send emails with other data. But yeah, either way, it's not a great place to be in. One item of note, I'll always, you know, even if it was a third party that got compromised, so you went to their actual legitimate website, which is what we try to instruct people, go to the real website, make sure, double check that you're typing it in correctly. If you are going to that site, it is compromised and it's giving you false information. The item for me is whenever anyone wants remote access to my computer, that's an indicator to me it's probably something not legitimate on the other side. And we do see this quite a bit with you know, Microsoft tech support scams. So you get a pop-up in the lower right. Hey, it looks like you have a virus. Please contact this phone number and we will help to get it cleaned up for you. And they make you buy some software, and then, you know, that software you just paid for ends up being malware, and they end up getting remote access to your computer. Anytime somebody wants remote access, that's kind of an indicator for me. This may not be legitimate. Because for any of those items they really need to assist you with, that remote access isn't needed. And while it's challenging, sometimes we have to give some more scrutiny to the people contacting us. You know, if I call my cell phone provider and I'm not sure it's them, I might want to ask them, well, how do I know it's you? I think that relationship goes both ways sometimes, where, you know, a provider will ask us information to validate we are who we say we are, which is good because it protects our account. But I think there's some situations, this, you know, might be a prime one of, well, how do I know you're actually Coinbase? How do I know that you have my account information and that this is a valid thing to do? But yeah, either way, it's challenging. It's a horrible situation to be in. I definitely recommend, you know, never give. I don't know if there's any legitimate situation in which you need to give remote access to your computer, unless it's actual tech support dealing with, you know, laptop. Like Geek Squad may be legitimate in terms of doing that kind of maintenance. Coinbase, they deal with back-end technology. It has nothing to do with your desktop or your laptop. They should never need remote access to your device. So when anyone ever asks you about remote access, I would generally, you know, lean towards caution and just say no, and then maybe double check the information. But even then, it's, you know, there's always a new tactic they're going to try to trick you or other people.
Yeah, I think that that something similar to that happened to me. I think it was 14 years ago now. It's been going, that kind of thing has been going on for a very long time, but it's easy to just kind of forget where you are and who's there, and you're in a problem like Jim had in Viroqua. Well, I'll tell you what, Trina's giving me some music in my ears, which tells me that it's time for a quick look at the news and finding out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. But Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, will be with us right up until 12:30 today to answer your questions, and you can still join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about technology today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jesse's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, and he helps establish and implement strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data and reduce institutional risk. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Tell us how you choose your email service provider, perhaps, or let us know why your email is encrypted, perhaps. Or do you have another tech question or comment? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And a caller, Darcy, online from Madison. Let's go there. Hi, Darcy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have an issue, or I had an issue. Yesterday afternoon, I started getting these spam notifications on it's a Pixel 6a, and it kept saying I have malware and somebody on a pornographic site is trying to reach you, and told me that I should press here to clean up my phone, and that Norton has expired, but I don't have Norton. And they just kept coming in, to the point where I had like 18 of them at a time. I cleared the notification screen, and then kept getting more and more and more until I called you, and now I don't have any. They disappeared. So I'm assuming that it was a scam. I didn't touch anything, but I had an appointment, but after my appointment, I was going to go to my provider and ask him what to do with it. But I'm assuming that was all just bombarded with spam.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Jesse. What do you think?
Yeah, and if it's via text message or SMS, it can be pretty common. A lot of the numbers, sometimes, they're kind of guessing in terms of what numbers to use, but sometimes they might gather phone numbers from other information to use. Either way, I think, contacting and stopping into your provider is a good idea, just to see what other services they have. And many of the devices, like your Pixel, will also have options to disable spam, or in some cases, you actually might have spam protection. They also may have notifications, which means that every time you get a spam message, outside of it just blocking spam, it's telling you that it actually blocked it, which is almost as bad as the spam itself. And you might be able to actually turn off those notifications, meaning that you won't even see the notifications that spam was blocked. There's always, potential danger there in terms of, will you miss something that was legitimate if you don't get notified about those spam messages being blocked? It's a possibility. Usually There are tools. If you have people in your phone book, they're always going to be allowed. But I do recommend, yeah, stopping your provider, give them some information. Maybe they'll have some examples, but they can definitely help you with some phone settings and maybe some services they have on their side. But yeah, unfortunately, that's the one challenge with a lot of texting and even just phone. The security built in to really address a lot of that is really challenging, especially since it's really easy for somebody to fake somebody else's phone number. So hopefully over time that gets better, but it might've stopped today, but stop by your provider because you might get more tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Darcy, for calling. Appreciate it. Another listener wonders in an email, how would someone go about erasing all the data and emails, accounts they have used, and start over fresh? They assume they'd have to sort of manually go in and change the email linked with accounts. And then if you delete a social media account, how do you ensure that your data is also deleted or erased?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so we'll tackle the email first. So if you wanted to keep the same email address, but remove all the messaging, you know, you can do that within most of the services. Sometimes I'll actually have a, you know, clean up my data or delete all my data option, which allows you to clean it up all from scratch. What I always recommend doing, if you wanted to start clean, maybe even get new addresses, get new accounts, before just deactivating your account, one, delete all your data, then deactivate your account. Just because at least you have a little bit more control over what you're doing. The providers that you're using may keep some of that data for a limited amount of time if you do decide to reactivate your account. And just because the fact sometimes people, I've done it myself, accidentally delete something. So they want to give you a restore mechanism. So I do recommend deleting it yourself. Wait a certain amount of time to make sure that the vendor deletes it. Then I'd probably recommend deactivating your account. And then you can kind of create something new or start from scratch. I know with some of the services, even if you deactivate your account, it kind of still hangs out there waiting for you to reactivate it at pretty much any time in the future. Some of that can be really tricky. I know I've seen that with Instagram and some others in the past where your deactivation is less of a deactivation and more of a I'll be back button. And whether that's in 1 year or 10 years. But I do remember deleting, or I do recommend deleting as much of the data as you can yourself before deactivating it, just to try and clear out as much of your account as you can, and then creating new ones from scratch. If you are doing new email addresses, new social media, keep track of who you'll be communicating with, because you might need to give proactive notice of, hey, I'm going to delete this. I'll no longer have access to it. Here's going to be my new forms of communication, my new accounts. That way, hopefully most people will be able to find you using those new accounts when you switch to it. But it can be kind of tricky. And some providers keep that data around a little bit longer. So I do recommend looking at the terms of service, because deletion of accounts and data, they'll usually have language in terms of how long they might keep data around if you were to reactivate account or if you needed to do it for restoration purposes. You want to make sure that restore period passes. So at least you can be a little bit more confident based on their privacy terms that your data is actually gone.
And then in terms of the, deleting the social media account and then ensuring the data is erased from that is kind of.
Yeah. And that's the same thing. Sometimes they'll have they'll have a reset button. Sometimes they won't. For a lot of people, I think, especially like Facebook, you might want to keep some of the old data, you know, request the download all my data. Sometimes it takes about a week. Download it, then go ahead and if they have a kind of clear my data option, that's great. Otherwise, it might be more of a manual cleanup and then deactivation of the account. but unfortunately each social media provider is going to be a little bit different. So the process to go through that's going to be a little bit different for every app. But whether it's email or social media, if I can delete as much of the content myself so I can't see it, it means generally somebody else can't see it. And then I'd like to go ahead and deactivate the account. So even in the case where somebody somehow gets access, reactivates it, or something else happens, the data's not there.
Let's go to Richard in Milwaukee next. Hi, Richard. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if I frequently have to go in for tech reps, or I have to call in for tech rep help. And I'm wondering if there's any bonding or security clearance that these technical reps, especially the ones that access remote, whether they have to have some sort of pre-qualification so you feel more secure about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's, you know, a situation we're commonly placed in, you know, whether we're working with a vendor or a company doing work. Being a general consumer, it might be hard to ask some of the questions. As an organization, I might say, hey, you know, tell me about your background check for your employees. Do you have annual security awareness training? Do you have worker confidentiality agreements? I do like to take a look at that. That actually might be in their terms of service. It might also be in their privacy policy stated in terms of these are the things we do for the employees or contractors that we work with. To make sure that, you know, your data is secure, that everyone's aware of the sensitivity of that data. Sometimes it's actually hard to get to, especially if they're smaller organizations. Remote access to computers is a bit more tricky just because, you know, they could be anywhere in the world. It's hard to really know whether they've done background checks for everyone or what that vetting process is. But I do recommend... even asking the vendor pretty plainly, show me the documentation, or at least that you stated in policy that you perform these checks of your employees or your contractors. If they can't do that, maybe that's an indication not to use that provider. If you're in a store, let's say it's Geek Squad's come up previously today. If you're in a store that's locally owned or operated, you can physically see the individuals. They may have, you know, bigger organizations may have the capability of showing these are the processes we go at when we hire employees. And more individuals and companies are asking that of vendors these days. So they shouldn't be abnormal questions. I think it's the responsibility of those organizations to kind of state, this is how we're protecting your information and this is how we're making sure your data is not going to be at risk. So I recommend asking the question. If they don't have a good answer, maybe they do all the things and are just not willing to share. That would at least be data for me. Maybe I don't want to be in a relationship with that organization. It's at, you know, all the power is still in your corner. So you can choose not to work with a certain company or with a certain individual. So I, you know, look at their documentation, ask the question, for remote support, you know, that can be tricky, but larger corporations are going to have more documentation and they're going to be more willing to share it with you. Because, you know, honestly, they have the resources to do that. Smaller companies, may have, more of a challenge, for background checks or less process. But ask, and hopefully you'll get the answers that help you feel more trust to that provider.
Let's go to an email from Sandra. She recently replaced an old Mac with a new MacBook Air M2. She feels like she's not using the upgrade to its potential and wonders, other than at an Apple store, are there classes available in the Madison area that can help her learn more? She's looking for general information about the use of the device.
Oh, that is an excellent question. And I do not have a course list off the top of my head. I do recommend, you know, there are a variety of publications for kind of local areas. you know, for example, in, you know, Madison, we have a variety of organizations, both public and private, that help to instruct people how to use later technology or how to get the most for their money. You can find them in stores. You know, I work for a college. They have a variety of classes on how to use technology, whether that's for Mac, Windows, or other software. I would take a look at your local publications to see what kinds of services are available for you. In the Madison area, we have MSCR, we have various universities and colleges. We also have a lot of companies that do tech support or sell technology on a regular basis that might also have their own classes. I also know Apple actually does. The Apple store might actually be a great place to walk into because they may have a catalog of these are all the different places you might be able to get some more information about your device. Apple wants you to use your device to the fullest extent. And actually stopping into an Apple store could be a great way to get some feedback from one of their employees. They may or may not have the information from a lot of third parties, but sometimes you'd be surprised just by asking where, you know, maybe they're keeping a list because it's been asked of so much. So I'd say the short answer is yes, but it's probably going to be, a different list depending on exactly where you are. And actually, the list could be pretty extensive. You might find that there are a variety of areas that are willing to help you on how to use your device and how to maybe get more use out of it.
Jim emailed, he has spent a couple of hours trying to edit a house listing on Messenger. The problem is the one problem he's having is posting and or additional edits. The instructions to do this for a less computer knowledgeable adult are terrible.
Yeah, a lot of the services can be a little bit more challenging to use. And if using Messenger, which I'm guessing is Facebook Messenger, that's kind of the guess I'm making. They have some documentation going to be a little bit more challenging. Sometimes you can find some assistance outside in the area. But I'd also, I think we've all had our local tech experts, maybe in our family. You might want to find somebody that has used it a little bit more in terms of selling or putting up information for sale. That can kind of help you through it, but sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging, especially if you haven't had to do it a whole lot.
A listener emailed, what's the harm if they delete cache files?
Generally, if it's, let's say, a web browser in your local cache, that cache is there really to make websites load faster. One of the downsides to cache is maybe you're loading old content. The website, for example, may have been updated and you're actually looking at an old version. A downside to deleting cache could be the website might take a little bit longer to load. Usually that's not too much of a problem. Internets is relatively fast in many cases, and most computers tend to be overpowered these days. So hopefully it shouldn't be that much of an issue. If you have other content saved, maybe passwords, if they're included in that cache, maybe you could lose autofill data. Usually that's going to be called out completely separately when you're deleting that data from a browser. But that's the only other thing I'd keep in mind. Really, it's just going to take a little bit longer, but you might not even notice, but you're going to get the most up-to-date content.
And here's another one. How do I download photos from my camera into an Apple laptop?
Probably it depends on your camera. There are a couple of different ways. Most cameras have an SD card that you can take out and then use an adapter to plug into your device. It shows up like a flash drive or an external hard drive, easy to copy and paste. Otherwise, you might be able to just plug in your camera, turn it on, and it'll actually mount on your device and actually import into iTunes pretty automatically. So it depends on which route you want to go. I tend to like the first option because sometimes plugging in devices and other devices don't work as well, or it's just not as compatible. So I do like to use micro SD or SD card adapters. Most of the time they're going to come with your camera. Otherwise, you can get them pretty inexpensively at a store online. And then if you get new devices like that, it's easy enough to plug in.
And here's another one. It could be cheaper to repair your phone or computer by yourself. A common DIY repair is to replace a phone's old battery. Generally, how easy of a replacement is that to make?
Yeah, I've replaced screens quite a bit, actually. And taking apart any kind of small electronic like that is challenging to keep track of screws, especially when they're really small. And there's a level of comfort you have with kind of cracking open. And I say cracking open because sometimes when you do need to open the device, there's a little bit of snapping, which is anticipated. It depends on your comfort of not breaking it. If you're okay with like, I might screw up and this might be bad, I'd say go ahead. If you've taken apart electronics, do it. It does differ based on the device because there might be more cables, might be less cables, might be tinier screws. You may not need actual special screwdrivers just due to the size. And so all of those come into account. There's a lot of great tutorials on YouTube, probably for just about every device. Take a look at those. They usually give you tips. They'll tell you the equipment that you need to use. And if you actually buy kits online, sometimes those kits come with tools, they come with instructions, and they come with YouTube videos. So they walk you through the whole process. But if you've never done it before, it might be a bit challenging. But if you're patient and go through the process, in many cases, it can go well as long as you're willing to take up that challenge.
I don't know. Somehow my fingers are not built to handle those really small screws.
I
would not even try it.
And they some of those kits actually come with tweezers. So they actually have a lot of those in mind. And so when you get the tools, they may be magnetically tipped and they'll have tweezers. So they do try to help you through that too.
Yeah, well,
the tape is good.
I am going to have somebody else do that for me. Oh, man. On that happy note, Jesse, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit.
Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Jesse LeGru is Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He does a great job. Always fun to have him with us. And we will get him back, and we will do this all over again. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit an Oconomowoc senior living community where a Michelin star chef is cooking up meals for residents. Oh, I'd like to visit there. We'll also visit the dentist's office to learn more about the technology associated with keeping your teeth clean, among other things. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.